When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to the Whitetail Podcast. I'm Paul Chapman, joined by Patrick Johnson, Ed Willis, while Ben Kuzma makes his way through his travel dilemmas in the snow from Montreal to Ottawa. I will start off by saying this podcast is brought to you by Key West Ford. KeyWestFord.com, BC's largest selection of Mustangs and also trucks. If you're interested, they're good with that. KeyWestFord.com. Gentlemen, we're going to talk a little bit of the Canucks road trip. We'll talk about the goaltending situation with Scoop Johnson over there. I want to talk a little bit Quinn Hughes, Tyler Toffoli, and of course our anniversary series. So without further ado, game in Montreal, down 2-0. Even though I wouldn't say you'd fault Demko coming on the heels of, oh, their MVP goalie is out for the rest of the regular season, perhaps. It looked like the roof was caving in and the Canucks did what I've not expected them to do all season, which was bounce back and look pretty good in doing it.
Yeah, well, it comes down to, you know, they'll always, and I think we talked about this on one of our fabulous White Towel videos, they will always talk about resiliency and character and grit and determination. The biggest difference with this team is they can score goals. And that will mask a multitude of sins. And, you know, any one of the last 4 years, they get down 2-0 on the road. I mean, you may as well end the game at that point. But they stick with it. It breeds a certain level of confidence when you've got 620 goal scorers in the lineup. And I was just scratching them all out. And basically, that's what they have now. When you've got a power play, when you can score from different places in your lineup, too, you're just not counting on two or three guys. It just makes the world of difference. To me, it's that simple with this team. That's the biggest difference.
And the big counterpoint is right in front of them is the Arizona Coyotes, a team that we thought, I think, was going to do just enough, you know, play strong defense. It's why they added Taylor Hall. They couldn't score enough. They haven't scored enough, and it's all fallen apart for that team. You look, I mean, as Ed mentioned, you look at the Canucks from the last couple of years. They couldn't do that, and you know what? Thank goodness they've had a very good goalie.
Well, they have, but you know, I think Ed's point of being able to score goals is, I mean, this has been a dream scenario for Jim Benning, and that you've got guys like Miller pitching in. You got the new guy, Toffoli, pitching in. You've got Jake Virtanen pitching in. You look at, you know, the 9-3 pasting of Boston. Mm-hmm. This isn't all focused on Pettersson. And if before the season, if you'd drawn out this scenario as to where they are and you said, yeah, but they're going to lose Brock Besser for the end of the year, you'd be chicken littling it, wouldn't you?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. And it is. And, you know, and again, you know, The Toffoli acquisition, I think we're probably going to get into it a little deeper later on. There's so many levels to it. But when was the last time the Canucks are like with the big game hunter at the trade deadline, the ones that kind of shaped the market, the ones that were aggressive and went out and got, you know, that big piece that a lot of teams were after? I mean, it comes down to the end of the season. Let's just say Vancouver makes the playoffs and Calgary doesn't. It could be because they were the ones that went out and got Toffoli.
Yeah.
Calgary didn't want to pay the price. And the price at the time did seem steep. I think it gave a lot of people pause. When you saw the prices that were being paid at the deadline, all of a sudden that seemed a lot more reasonable.
He was, I suppose, the, if not the number one forward available among the top
in the fourth conversation, sure.
Certainly, yeah, right? Yeah. And you look at what other teams, I mean, Vincent Trocheck, probably another big scoop up for the Hurricanes. And I think the Hurricanes, in the big picture, are the big winners, having added him and then a couple top end defensemen. But yeah, I mean, Toffoli was a big move. Now it's interesting to me because last week when they added him. I asked Jim, Jim, would you have made this trade without the injuries? He said no. And then on Monday, I think he got asked a similar question and kind of answered slightly differently, saying, you know, I think trying to say, well, look how well it's gone. So, of course, I was trying to make all these deals. But in the end, Toffoli makes their team better if Besser's back. And I noticed Besser was skating with kids from Children's Hospital at Rogers Arena the other day, looking like, you know, he pushed a kid in a wheelchair. So, you know, obviously feeling okay. Maybe he isn't out for that long. And certainly if he's able to come back sooner rather than later, all of a sudden, yeah, they are a lot deeper up front than they were 2 weeks ago.
I asked Ed about this in one of our videos as well. Quinn Hughes, remarkable numbers. Are you surprised, Patrick, that he is where he is?
It's amazing. I mean, I thought he was going to be good. I think everybody sort of thought he'd be good. But he's the number one defenseman on this team. You know, he's not killing penalties. But if it's 5-on-5 and they need something to happen, he's on the ice. And that's been one of the more impressive things about him, is just the level of trust, because he's so good with the puck. And he makes so many good decisions. We've seen him make mistakes. That's going to happen. But he's been so good with the puck. And just it's that ability to sort of turn on a dime, the button hook he does out by the blue line, and just doesn't care. And I was talking to JT Miller about this the other day, and he sort of said, you know, it's what the way he puts himself into people when he has the puck that surprised him, because he's just a little guy, but he's a player that clearly understands, you know, sort of things like center of gravity, and a taller player is going to have a higher center of gravity, and he can kind of get under that and make it harder for people to defend you. It's so impressive to watch a player who has such an innate understanding of his sort of physical tools, his physical abilities, and he does it every night, and he's just getting better.
I don't know about you, but I can almost set my watch by this. Once every 2 weeks, I'll get an email from a fan, and the fact that it's an email might tell you something about the demographic here. But he, and it'll say, yeah, but, you know, Hughes is a liability in his own end. Yeah, but what are you watching? Are you kidding me? You know, the Canucks finally get this one thing they haven't had in 50 years. And yeah, it does show up. The odd time, but it's, you know, that's like this little kernel over here. See what I'm doing here? I'm providing visuals on a podcast. That's really
it's like
good,
making,
isn't it?
So like a very small gesture.
It's a very small thing versus a very big thing over here. No, it's amazing. Like Patrick, what did you? I thought, boy, if they get 35 points out of this guy, that's a hell of a season.
Beautiful. Yeah.
You know, maybe he gets on the second power play and things like that. He's just changed so many things for this franchise, and he just turned 20. This is just the start. He's just such a smart kid, and he gets everything. He gets the hockey environment. He gets where he needs to go. I just think his game is going to become a little more well-rounded, a little more refined as it evolves. And I think we're talking, I know this is crazy, I think we're talking about the best defenseman in Canucks history.
Well, and you look at Paul, you tweeted it at me, but the list of comparable rookie defensemen and the point
there
totals.
Was a reason why I tweeted at you.
No, I know, but it is a fun list, and you think about both the names on the list and the context for when they were playing versus when Quinn Hughes is playing now. And he's, you know, this is a season up there with Potvin, Bork, Leach, Housley, Murphy, Talon. You know, guys
they
that all
watch.
Played, you know, 30, 40 years ago in an
Barry
era.
Barry Beck's on that list too.
Barry Beck. You know, but, you know, guys that played in the 70s and into the 80s, an era that was, you know, I think on the whole less focused defensively. And you look at how he's performing in an era that is intensely focused on defense, and he's putting up the points. It is a remarkable rookie season, something that I think we are going to be talking about for a very, very long time.
And not just last night, we've seen it a little bit, but last night in particular, the Canadians seemed to target him physically. I'm not comparing him to Wayne Gretzky at all, but there was this big thing I remember when Gretzky was really bursting out, and, you know, the old school hockey heads were like, just hit him, just lay the physical element down on him. You know, and Hughes took a couple of shots, as he has all season, but you can't get him. That's the comparison to Gretzky, is like, he avoids contact. He's not the Chris Tanev being stapled to the boards every time he has the puck. How is he set up to handle, do you think, into the playoffs where it does get turned up physically?
Well, yeah, I think there will be an adjustment period. But again, I just go back to the way he assimilates information and uses it to his advantage. And, you know, to Patrick's point, he just understands the physics of the game. So is that physics? I think it's physics.
It is.
The physics of the game so well, and you know, and leverage and body position and all those things. And I'm trying to remember who it was who said it, but somebody was asking a small player about what it's like to be a small player, and he said, "Well, I've been a small player all my life. It's the only thing I know." And I think that
reminds me of the Doug Williams question of the Super Bowl, Ed.
Well, I want to say it was Theo Fleury. That's what I want to say again. But you know, Hughes has been that player all his life, and he's had to learn to adapt, and he's obviously played at a high, high, high level since he was 12, 13, 14 years old. So every step along the way, again, you know, he's kind of accumulated the information. This is what I need to do. This I can't. I can go here, but I can't go there. I can do this, but I can't do that. So yeah, it will be interesting. And I thought, you know, early on, you know, he took a couple of hits. Pettersson's kind of going through the same thing. It's part of the process.
Nice segue. I wanted to ask both of you, but Patrick, we'll start with you, about it was around this time last year that we saw Pettersson kind of start to hit the wall. What do you expect down the stretch from Quinn Hughes? This is his first full season. And Pettersson, you know, there are demands on his game, certainly. But it doesn't. He's not showing the same signs of fatigue and frustration that perhaps we saw last year.
The Hughes thing is interesting. They're clearly being conscious to manage his minutes whenever they can. You look at the Boston game and he only played 17 minutes. I mean, the fact they were scoring a ton, the things were going so well, they didn't need to chase the game. That was totally by design. That was a chance to give the kid a break because he's been playing so much and he's going to be playing a lot. Everything says that he's going to keep playing the way he's been playing. So I'm not, you know, even though you're right, this is now going to be the longest season he's ever had. I'm not so worried about him. Pettersson, I think Pettersson's going to be fine. I think he might be dealing with something. I mean, we remember the Greslick hit. You know, he had to sit out a game after that. I have no doubt he's probably feeling a little stiff in his lower back still from that, whatever it was. His line scoring, I'm not too worried about it. I mean, Miller just continues to be a force. Toffoli has scored since arriving, and none of them have been terribly fluke goals. This is a guy that knows how to find the net. I'm not terribly worried. In fact, the way Toffoli has come in, he's such an impressive player. You can again see why he's a player that Jim Benning would like. He's got some size to him. You know, he's a big, strong guy. He knows where the net is. He goes to the net. He's a classic, you know, Daryl Sutter kind of player. And the Canucks seem to love those kinds of guys now. I think he's a guy that's also, as well, because he's a real threat in the long run, if he stays with Pettersson, he's going to open up space again for Pettersson. And Pettersson, not that he's had any trouble finding space, but I think maybe he's dealing with something. But in the end, in the long run, I'm not sweating it like I was last year.
That's a big part of the way this, I would suggest, even with Pettersson's mindset in terms of adjusting to the grind in this year, Ed, is that he doesn't have to carry it all himself.
Oh, I think that's the big point. I read somewhere, I wasn't even aware of this, which says something. I think Pettersson has something along the lines of 3 goals in his last 15 games, which is about the point last year. And remember, people were pulling their hair out last year. Well, he's hit a wall. He physically isn't able to handle the grind, all these things. Well, nobody's really noticed because everybody else around him is scoring. It's not like they rely on him. So he can do his thing on the power play, and he's still got, I mean, to me, the thing I like best about his game is the 200-foot aspect. He competes hard in the defensive end. He doesn't cheat on the offensive end. And they're continuing to score goals. I mean, JT Miller has just been such a revelation for me this season for what he is. And Toffoli looks like a right-handed version of Miller. He's just, you know, a gritty two-way player who's got enough skill, not high-end skill, but certainly enough skill. Just what the doctor ordered.
Again, Ed, you're making this look as if I scripted this out and we're all organized and we know what we're talking about instead of just winging it. But I did want to ask both of you about this. Start with you, though, Ed. When Miller was brought in, on that trade, aside from everyone arguing about what the price was paid and whether they had to pay that much, I kind of wondered about the mindset of a guy who was on a President's Trophy winning team in Tampa Bay, seemed like, you know, it was the ideal place to be, and now he's coming to Vancouver, nowhere near the playoffs in the last 5 years. Toffoli, okay, LA was not good. They're clearly in a rebuilding phase, but there's all this talk. His wife works in the movie industry. He won't re-sign here, everything else. You're talking about two guys who have come to Vancouver and couldn't look happier to be here. Like, is this now, once again, as we revisit the late 2000s, a great place to for a hockey player to be?
Well, isn't it an interesting one? For me, for the Toffoli trade to really work for this organization, they have to sign him. And when you think of what he represents, again, he's basically JT Miller. He's 27 years old. They're going to have to pay a premium to sign him. But you look at Miller's numbers. Is that going to get it done? I don't know. What do you think, Patrick? Is five and a half going to get it done for Toffoli?
It's something like that. Yeah. I mean,
it's in the ballpark. Yeah. But yeah, it just Miller again. And I want to go back to this because I remember when the trade was made, I tweeted out something along the lines of, and there's no shitstorm like a Twitter shitstorm, but I tweeted out something along the lines of Jim Benning seems to be making a point of Bride to accumulate as many average forwards as he can. And when you look at Miller's season in Tampa last year, that's what he was. He was an average user. Kind of a third line guy who might be able to move up the lineup, and the Canucks already had half a dozen of those guys. Now, if you knew you were going to get this like point a game offensive driver, leader, physical guy who's going to take so much pressure off so many players, you would have paid twice what the Canucks paid for him. But, you know, full credit to him. He's stepped up in here, he's been given this role, and he's embraced it.
Patrick, you again, like you're in that room every day. I think there's something. I don't want to say they're like the 2010-2011 group that started to form into a real contender, but you sort of see this closeness amongst them. And I know there was always talk about Toffoli and Pearson are tight. Miller just seems so happy. Everyone's talked about that. No one's even really talked about Tyler Myers this year to the point that he's fit in well. We know that the young players seem really like. Has this group got the chemistry? I mean, it's easy to throw players together, but as I said, people are happy to be here. This group looks like they like each other.
Yeah, I think that's a nice thing. That's a helpful thing for a coach. I mean, there are examples in the past, like, I don't know, the 2003 Vancouver Canucks, if you want groups that maybe didn't get along so well but still achieved anyway.
But we only have to look to the John Tortorella era to maybe look at things a little bit closer.
Right. Chemistry is a nice thing. It's good to have. It helps. It certainly helps the coach that he doesn't have to think as much about that kind of thing. At the end of the day, he knows these guys are professionals. They come in, they work hard, and they get it. These guys are pushing each other. And it is that thing where you hear the sort of legacy of the Sedins about how important their sort of get down to work attitude was, and it remains the case. And we go back to the Kevin Bieksa speech at the retirement night was that, you know, that their spirit lives on in some of these guys that he's met. And it is a thing, I think, for this team that is absolutely, it's not a thing they have to worry about. Can we make a change here or there? Can we juggle a guy here or there? It does from the outside seem to be a pretty good group. Certainly the guys that are the top players on this team are guys that are instinctual leaders and guys that are, you know, used to sort of leading the charge and have that, instinctual mentality in terms of what needs to be said, when it needs to be said, what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, that kind of thing.
Case Scoop Johnson, let's get into this. Markstrom out with a meniscus. Look, we've been talking all season about at an MVP level Markstrom's been playing out. How big a loss is it?
It's as bad as could be. I mean, Thatcher Demko has lots of potential. We've seen good things from him. I think we've also seen areas of his game that definitely need improvement. He hasn't been a guy that necessarily, I mean, I think he's stolen a couple of games this year, but not to the level that Markstrom has. You know, you think about especially that run after Christmas when they won all those games and a bunch of them they had no business winning, and it was entirely because of Jacob Markstrom. So yeah, he's been their MVP. You know, they're nowhere without him. You know, depending on what metrics you want to look at, there's a whole different ways to judge it. But, I mean, everything says he's been as good as our eyeballs tell us he's been. And replacing him is a big task for Thatcher Demko.
Ed? Yeah, well, I think it's expectations. If you're expecting him to supply that Markstrom level, and there are, as what Patrick says about metrics, there are a ton of metrics that suggest Markstrom's been the best goalie in the NHL this season. So if you're expecting that, you're probably going to be disappointed. But I still think he's capable of providing a professional level of goaltending. You look at his save percentage now, it's about 905, 906. If he keeps it there, the Canucks will probably win enough games down the stretch to get into the playoffs. If he slumps, then they've got a problem. But, you know, he's kind of been born for this. And, you know, he was drafted in the second round. He was brought along, had a couple of standout seasons in Utica. He had like sort of, you know, what, three quarters of a season last year as the backup. He's been part of the team all this year. He's been working with Ian Clark all along. There is nothing to suggest that the bottom's going to fall out for this kid. So I expect him to kind of still provide that same level of goaltending he's provided this year.
Okay, so let's just say that it's one thing as well, let's be honest, to come in and play every couple of weeks and then either to be the guy and get lots of games and get in a rhythm. Let's say that he really does shine and the Canucks don't see much of a drop-off in terms of their record or while Markstrom's out. Does that change their thinking about the summer?
Is it the Matt Murray situation?
Exactly.
You know, I think it has to. I think it has to.
So you think if he's like really strong now down the stretch and is like, wow, he's playing great, you let Markstrom walk?
That's it makes you think about it.
No, absolutely it does.
It certainly makes you reassess things. We've talked about it on this podcast before, about what teams are willing to invest in goaltending. And there is a model out there, and it's provided by Pittsburgh, by Columbus. There's a couple of other teams that just decided Philadelphia. They just said, screw it. We're going to go with the young guy. We're going to pay him next to nothing. And we think our team is good enough that we can win around him while he develops into a number one goalie. And that model is certainly available to the Canucks. And you're talking about they're probably going to be saving in the neighborhood of $6 million a year. If Markstrom does go, they've got Demko on another year at nothing. That's out there. Now, that is so risky for a team that's kind of finally taken this step forward. And the biggest reason is the guy you're going to get walk. I'm just saying that scenario is out there, and you can make a case that maybe it applies. And that's why these next, though, as interesting as they are on so many levels for the Canucks, it's really interesting on that level. Matt Murray.
Columbus is an interesting one because, of course, you look at Bobrovsky and look what's happened in Florida. I mean, that's the other argument. I would suggest, Patrick, that's maybe the bigger concern there is what the Canucks have tied up in the cap. So then it becomes an issue rather than, you know, saying, well, you know, they should let Markstrom walk because they'll be okay. It just becomes about their cap management at that point.
Well, I think it also... It's sort of a bigger question about how do you balance the goaltender versus the reality of your defense, which is that it's not a very good defensive defense, if you know what I mean. And your sort of key cogs there right now remain, well, Quinn Hughes, obviously, because he just never has to play defense because he's so good at moving the puck up the ice. But you know, the likes of Alex Edler, who remains a really effective player. He's not, I mean, he was never the fleetest of foot to begin with, but he's not very fast anymore anyway. Still makes smart plays on the puck, but defensively, you know, is not going to get any better. You know, and I have to be honest, Chris Tanev, who has been such a rock for so long, but again, another guy where the skating is falling off, and you worry how quickly that's going to happen. I mean, he's having his healthiest season ever, touch wood. And so you sit there and go, he's a guy that needs a contract. You know, what's more important, him or Jacob Markstrom? And I think the choice, if you're picking actually between those two, I think you actually pick Markstrom, because Markstrom's been good. You have every reason to think he's going to be good for another couple seasons. You know, I think, Ed, you touched on some numbers last week on where his contract's at, but it's also that question of term. How long are you going to keep him around? And I think that, to me, there's almost a case where you say, well, you keep Markstrom and you just let Tanev walk. Like, I mean, I would have, there was a huge case to be made still to trade him. They didn't, I didn't think they ever were going to. But at this point, you have to sort of say, where are we going to be going with this? Who is going to be the best fit with Quinn Hughes next year? You know, I would love to see Tyler Myers with him. I think you make them a great puck moving duo. Myers is not again, another guy that's not great in his own end. But if you're playing with Quinn Hughes, you're never playing in your own end. So what's the big deal? Myers has great offensive instincts. I think that's when maybe you can swap that one out, and then you start looking at what you're going to do in the rest of your roster.
Okay, well, both you guys will finish up with, before we get into some anniversary talk, but with the current team, what's your sense of how they're going to finish the season here? And where do they go? I think it's, unless, as Ed said, unless the goaltending completely crashes, right, I think it's a safe assumption that they're going to get into the playoffs. Yeah. It's just whether, you know, they'll be first in the Pacific or they'll be a wild card or who the matchup is. What's your sense of how they're going to finish and where they'll be?
Well, you mentioned them earlier, Calgary, who actually didn't end up. I mean, they added a couple defensemen. They needed more defensemen. But I'm still not convinced with their goaltending. I'm still not, they just, they just don't. You talk about a team that doesn't seem to actually be all that happy in the room. That seems like that team. And you know, I think the Oilers. I mean, what a job at Dave Tippett's done as a coach. Ken Hall and actually shoring up, finding some really interesting gambles. I think he did a great job on Monday, adding Mike Green on defense, adding a couple very interesting kind of depth forwards. I think the Oilers have really solidified things. I think, you know, the Canucks are definitely in the mix with them. The Flames, I think, are going to be the fourth wheel there, and it's about the Flames trying to sneak into sort of a wild card spot. They've done so much work, the Canucks have, this season, getting to this point, you know, playing, you know, above 500 hockey, whatever that means now, but doing everything they needed to do to get them this far, to deal with the what if. What if we have a problem? What if we don't win as much as we have in the past? And I think they've done enough. They're going to be fine. As we saw in the end, Montreal was not an amazing performance, but they did enough to win. And at this point, that's all they need to do.
Yeah, I think they make the playoffs. I just wanted to sort of dovetail something we were talking about 5-10 minutes ago.
And it's a way of saying that we're talking too much, Patrick.
I'd never say that. But it's the way this offseason is shaping up, and we're really going to find something out about Benning as a general manager here. Because now he's got – like, he's been able to accumulate and all that, and really hasn't had to worry a ton about the payroll, which is really good because he's got some terrible contracts there. But now all of a sudden he's got to make some hard choices. He's got to, you know, do some finessing. He's got to do it's going to be really interesting to watch what he comes out with at the end of this season.
I'll just say what I'm really looking forward to, and this has been a season of anniversaries and ceremonies and everything else. All season long, it's been, we need to play meaningful games in March. Hey, this time next week, it's March. I'm expecting a banner. We played meaningful games in March. Let's have a ceremony. Come on, why not? We've done one for everyone else. While we're on that subject, it's not Sedin's week. Thank God. Love the Sedins, but little Sedin's out after everything that we went through. But as we continue our anniversary series brought to you by KeyWest4.com, to go back and read the stories of the mid-2000s, and of course we had some amazing stuff last week on the death of Luc Bourdon, and Ed, I know you had some great insight there, and also, you know, in hindsight, what he meant to heart and soul guys like Alex Burrows. We had Jason's original piece on the matter, but then into the emergence of the Alain Vigneault team and, you know, the chance he could have been fired and Luongo's shutout streak and home winning streaks and the emergence of the Sedins, stepping up of Bieksa and Kessler and Burrows. And you kind of, to me, I forgot so much of it. You just put everything in like, yeah, wasn't that a great team that went to the finals and won the President's Trophy twice? But it really was a fascinating era, those last like 4 years of the decade.
Well, so 08-09 is Gillis's first year as a general manager, correct? And this is, you know, there should be a book written on the Matt Sundin signing, because 100%. It was such a fascinating time and so many parts to it. But the 09-10 team comes out of that and the original intent was to have Sundin around for 2 years, pay him a whack load of money, and kind of build around him with Henrik as this second line center. And it obviously didn't work out that way. But for Henrik to step out from that shadow from 08-09 to the point where he wins the Art Ross and the Hart Trophy the next year, just an amazing development. Everybody had seen he was turned into a very good player, basically a point a game guy. But I don't think anybody saw the Hart Trophy winner or the Art Ross Trophy winner heading into that season.
I think I mentioned it before, but, you know, something Marcus Naslund told me when we talked about the Sedins, you know, his point really was that we didn't talk directly about why he left and how he had to leave, but, you know, that the Sedin twins that he saw as he left were very good players. And he's like, they would have carried on, they would have had long careers, they would have been these very good players. And he said, but in the end, we now know that in them, they knew they had so much more. And it's a credit to them for making that happen, because he said that was all about hard work. And then the Sundin thing is fascinating, because that was something I was kicking myself a little bit, because as I sort of realized, wait, you know, I mean, the framing of the story was, let's talk about this home winning streak from 08-09, but there's so much more going on. And as I sort of, because it was one of those ones, you're coming out of Sedin week. You know, I'd been on the road. I didn't really have my head around. And then when the last couple of days, when I finally started getting my head around, what is the story I'm actually doing? I said, wait a second. There's a Sundin aspect to it. There's this Kessler. This is the emergence of Kessler. This is who the player he becomes. And it's sort of as like, oh, this is how it all happens. And so, you know, I tried to see maybe if there's a way to get a hold of Sundin at the last minute, couldn't get a hold of him. Realized in hindsight, these were things I should have asked Kessler when he was here. By the way, had a very curious response. If you want to know about the realities of retirement in the NHL, well, Anaheim Ducks PR says, oh, I don't know how to get a hold of Ryan Kessler. Even though he's on their roster listed as a player, he's moved to Michigan. Anyway.
So what you're saying is don't go through the Panthers if you want to get Luongo.
But in the end, like, you know, Ryan Kessler would have been great. I mean, anyway, so I was very pleased that I was able to talk to Mike Gillis, who took, you're right, the Sundin thing would be an incredible, incredible story because it was such a clear choice in hindsight. I mean, maybe you understood at the time, Ed, because you were dealing with it. I didn't really think, I'd never thought about what it all meant, why they walked away from, I mean, the Linden, why they walked away from Linden's obvious, but why they walked away from Naslin, who had been the captain for so long. I mean, it was a real shift in direction of the team, and there's sort of this realization, as, you know, Gillis tells me in the story, that Kessler was a guy who could actually be so much more. He wasn't just this miscreant who was just a third line checking forward. He was a guy that needed to be empowered and pushed and pushed, and that playing him with Sundin and Pavel Dimitra just took him to a level that he had never really been almost offered before, and he made it happen. And as you said, I mean, 09-10 happens, and then they run, you know, they almost do it in 2011, 2 years later.
Yeah, that was one of the fun things going back and looking at the original reporting of that win streak, the home win streak, 11 games, was the emergence of Kessler and Burrows as offensive players.
Yeah.
But just to ask you both, and in particular you, Ed, because, you know, you've been at this longer than Patrick, but we know the Sedin twins are unique because of their twins and their relationship and everything else. But can you think of another player that emerged as like an elite Hart Trophy winning player, like 9-10 seasons in?
Wow.
Like when you look now, I know it probably wouldn't happen now because of the impatience of the league and the fans and everything else. But when you think of how we started this decade series, when they were drafted and really that they didn't emerge until like 2008, 2009, 2010, I can't think of another player who took so long to get to that high level.
Well, it's funny sitting here, Taylor Hall kind of pops to mind. Mm-hmm. He'd been in the league, and I know he was a younger player when he started, but he'd been in the league for a while. But I think history will tell us that season was going to be one of the great one-offs in NHL history. Probably not. I can think of players who kind of like took a step forward, maybe even a great leap forward. But like I think we were saying in an earlier video, with the Sedins, the thing that's amazing about me is just the way I'm going to get time-lapse photography right this time too. How they started, and each step along the way, the improvement was incremental. It wasn't astonishing. It was just kind of, they went from rookie players who were okay but struggled a bit to guys who looked like they were going to be really good support level players to point of game players. And you think that's okay. That's probably what they're going to be. They're going to top out there at, you know, 70 to 80 point players. And then they take the next leap, which is the hardest one of all, to go from that to winning trophies, to being recognized as amongst the best players of the day. But it was all kind of seemed so natural. There wasn't like a big dramatic cataclysmic moment where you go, wow, it just like, you know, these guys jumped out of the sky and look what we have here. It was just kind of a testament to the way they went about their work and their business and honing their craft.
With the whole time-lapse thing, it's given me an idea. I'll get Darm McQuana here, our producer and video editor, to do a claymation series of the Sedin's career.
Well,
throw our own budget at it.
No, honestly, if you did that with their faces, because remember they were kind of like these pudgy, cherubic kind of like young men from Sweden. And by the end, they've got these hard edges to their faces.
Yeah. Sliced cheese on their cheekbones.
Exactly. And I've always maintained you can tell so much about a player's evolution. We're starting to see it with Horvat now, too. His physiology is a little different, obviously, but, you know, you're starting to see that too.
It is astounding looking at those draft photos of the Sunnis, yeah. the video of them in the stands. You're like, are those the same people? Like, it is remarkable. And then, of course, you see their sons and you realize that there's definitely their fathers. So,
well, it is funny. There were a lot of people who really did have trouble telling them apart at the beginning. And then, you know, as they age, there's differences there. All right. I think we have to wrap that up. I will say, after we had Ed's visualization thing before, one of my favorite things was aforementioned producer Dharma Kwana shooting dirty looks at Patrick every time he touched the table with his hands, which is a no-no. Probably missed about 15 or 16 of those. So thanks to Dharma.
Doesn't that qualify as ambient sound, though? Doesn't it capture the intensity?
Well, now he has
to
go edit that out, right? But I'm giving him the pass to leave it in so people will get the reference.
The Beatles had George Martin. We've got Dharma.
So thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to KeyWestFord.com for being a sponsor. And we will talk to you guys next week.